I guess from now you're at the U.S. Naval Academy, and he was or he still is a grad student.
Still at Cambridge.
Cambridge?
Planning to finish up in January of 09.
Great. And you're going to tell us something about finite states in four-dimensional quantum mechanics.
Okay, good afternoon. It's my pleasure to come and talk about finite states. What you see here is that's a picture of the Naval Academy, some of the academic buildings. And these are our midshipmen in uniform. They're in training to become officers in the Navy and the Marine Corps of the United States. And I think at the moment they're probably on their way to physics class. And I teach in that building right there. Some of those might be students who potentially could be mine, depending on the age of the picture. So moving on to finite states. Well, there are many people who don't believe there's such a thing as a finite state in quantum gravity. But I've tried to look at that from a different approach. Well, it may be difficult to tell what quantum gravity really looks like in the full world.
Was it me who did something? No, it's
not you,
Jim.
It's the chair. It's not sure.
It's okay. Just let them do it.
No worries. There are other ships like this.
It's okay. When you stop it, it's okay.
Okay, good. Let's start going with the science.
Okay, sorry. It might be hard to decipher what the underlying physics is at the Planck scale, quantum gravity. But I kind of take the approach that, well, we know what physics looks like below the Planck scale. In other words, where special relativity and quantum field theory would hold, typically. So if we could take physics at that scale and limit where you could essentially turn off gravity and take that physics and put it into a machine, and the machine essentially grinds a crank and then it extrapolates that physics all the way to the Planck scale. And maybe it'll give you a good approximation of what it really does look like at such a high scale. But the crank should turn in such a way that's consistent with the axioms of quantum field theory as well as the dynamics of quantum general relativity. So some of the things that I've found, well, if there is such a thing as a finite state in quantum gravity, the implications I list them here. Usually amongst different quantization procedures, there are ambiguities, so path integral quantization, canonical, and so forth, geometric. But for this class of states, of finite states, there would be no ambiguities amongst those procedures. They would produce the same state, eliminate those ambiguities. Now also, you wouldn't need to access a Planck scale to measure quantum gravitational effects, because essentially what I'll show you we've done is you input the physics below the Planck scale into the model, and then it extrapolates. So if that were the case, then a question one could ask is it possible for quantum gravity at such a high scale to place constraints on observations we could make in everyday physics? And if so, would those observations be consistent with finite quantum gravity? Some other things. So you'd be able to verify the semi-classical limit. I think that's guaranteed, and I'll show you how. And regarding the cosmological constant problem, It turns out that the cosmological constant lambda is a fundamental parameter in the theory, so it's an expansion parameter. And the smaller that parameter is, the better the expansion is. Whereas in usual quantum field theory on Minkowski spacetime, you calculate the expectation value of the vacuum expectation value of the fields, and it predicts that it blows up. Right? So you get all these infinities. Well, perhaps a root cause of that might be, usual Minkowski physics doesn't take into account quantum gravity. We're looking at just special relativity. So maybe if it did take into account quantum gravity, you wouldn't get the cosmological constants blowing up, and it might explain why it's small. So we'll see a bit of that as well toward the latter part of the presentation. Any questions that come up throughout the presentation, don't hesitate to ask, because there are many things which they seem a bit strange as we go through. So I'll try and get you used to the ideas and the procedures. So first, we'll start with the pure covalent state. Transcendence functional for a self-dual SU2 connection. So I'm using the Ashkar variables with the connection and the densitized triads being the conjugate variables. I probably know a bit about the state. Claim to be an exact solution to the quantum constraints of GR, vacuum GR with a cosmological term, discovered by Hideo Kodama. Semi-classical limit corresponding to a distorted space-time below the Planck scale is one of its semi-classical orbits. And possible candidate for the ground state wave function of the universe. What I've shown up there is the Kodama state, and you can see it's the exponential of a Chern-Simons functional of that connection, that self-dual connection. So the version I have displayed there is a complex version. Now, how should we think about pure Kodama state?
The complex version being emergency parameter equal I?
That's correct. Emergency parameter equals I. So if that were a classical theory, say, of Yang-Mills, Chern-Simons, well, this term here might look kind of like a Lagrangian for the theory on a spatial hypersurface. But now we're using it as the wave function of the universe for pure gravity. And there are issues that have been pointed out by various people, including Ed Witten, which I've listed here. Normalizability and unitarity. So how do you normalize a wave function that's cubic, okay, that diverges? Okay. So that's one thing. And the other thing is unitarity. You try and construct a Fock space about the ground states. In Yang-Mills theory, you get states of negative energy and negative norms, so non-physical states. So
what do you mean by wave function is cubic? If the I is a cubed, then you have to...
There's a factor of a cubed, which we'll see on the next slide, in that Chern-Simons function.
Term in Chern-Simons
is cubed.
Regularization headaches or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that point was, you know...
Well, for instance, if you let A...
If I normalize ability.
If you let A go to infinity, for instance, let's say you take a very large value of A, then you could say that maybe the functional would be infinite. Because in the quantum theory, remember that the wave function tells you the amplitude for certain configurations of the field. And they don't necessarily have to be smooth functions of space, but it tells you for a given configuration what is the amplitude for that configuration. So if you put in, say, a large value for A, I mean, one could conclude that the wave function is infinite, so it doesn't make
any
sense.
And that point came up a few years ago when Lee and Laval worked on the fluctuations, mm-hmm. and the statement in that paper at the end was that the cubic term, that you couldn't do anything. So do you do something with it? Maybe
yes.
To see you.
Yes. I don't go into much detail in the talk, but essentially some of the ideas are, well, one thing is, since we're talking about complex connection, maybe when you're calculating norms, you deform the contour of integration parallel to the imaginary axis. So that cubic term is just a phase. So you could get it to converge.
Oh, that would be nice.
People have done that going into the triad representation of from the transcendence functional. And another thing is, well, what measure are you using for normalization? Okay, so I could, let's say I defined a transcendence functional as a fundamental variable. And I could choose a norm that's Gaussian in that variable and use that for my norm. And I would get convergent norms. But this is only just one state, one particular state. There are many states that are like the Kadama state. But those are some of the ways of approaching these objections, and I've taken some fair detailed looks at those. So it seems reasonable to me that that is a ground state wave function. So why is it special? I'm not sure if it's the only known non-trivial solution, but for a certain operator ordering, it is an exact solution to the constraints, both classical and quantum constraints. And that'll lead us to the semi-classical quantum correspondence in a couple of slides. Now, if you look at the wave function, what I've drawn there is a three-dimensional version. What if you were to extend that into space-time? And you can do so using certain techniques from path integration. You have a four-dimensional version of the state that looks somewhat similar to a topological invariant. And it's that feature of the state that allows you to project from one spatial hypersurface to another spatial hypersurface independently of how the fields evolve throughout space-time. So in a certain sense, I interpret that to be, it solves the problem at least of extrinsic time. And I'll show you that as well. And you could also take it off shell, and it looks sort of like a BF theory with two form fields at sigma. So those are just kind of different representations of
how does sigma get in there? I mean, what's sigma?
Well, if you were to do a path integral over this variable here, you could eliminate it and transform the...
The psi is a function of A. I can see how F is related to A, but what sigma is just...
This is an independent variable. It's used in BF theory. In this case, there are no constraints that impose metricity in the theory.
So the psi is no longer just a function of A, it's a function of A and sigma.
Yes, what I've done is I've...
You've extended somehow or another the...
I just took it off shell. But then I could put it back on shell.
It's about the integral over sigma, right?
Right, it's the integral over sigma.
And then you would have the equivalent between the two. But it's just an integral over d sigma.
An integral d sigma out in front of the exponential.
Oh, here?
No, before the exponential.
Is sigma?
Oh, I haven't shown the path integral. But you can imagine an integral d sigma on the outside.
Is sigma a dynamical field or an auxiliary field introduced to make it your second line equal to the first line?
It's an auxiliary field.
Okay.
So all I've done is I've just shown a different representation of the state, because for each representation, you can perform a canonical quantization procedure, and they have different implications.
Mm-hmm.
So, I call that the pure Kodama state because it corresponds just to pure gravity and nothing else. Cosmological term, no matter fields. But if the universe consisted of more than just pure gravity, so it had gravity and other fields, including matter fields, that are quantized on the same footing as gravity, then, well, how could the Kodama state be generalized to incorporate those fields? So what are we looking for the generalized event state? So we want a non-trivial exact solution to the constraints in the full theory, or mini superspace if you choose, both a semi-classical and a quantum state at the same time. So it satisfies the classical version of the constraints. So it looks kind of like a Hamilton-Jacobi functional. But it also satisfies the quantum version of the constraints. So you have a quantum wave function defined on a three-dimensional spatial hypersurface, just like the Chern-Simons function is. And you could do analogous transformations to get different interpretations of the state. And essentially a finite state, including matter. So that's the next degree of complexity. So how can we generalize the properties of the pure Cardano state to incorporate that? That brings us to the generalized Cardano state. So this essentially summarizes what I've just said. If you look at the generalized Cardano state, Psi G caught up there. So I have the connection, so that's the Ashtar connection. And now I have another field, and that represents all the matter fields that you want to couple to gravity. And they're labeled by an index, so call it A. So what we're looking for is a wave functional of those fields defined on a spatial hypersurface that solves the constraints. Now, one of the things that may be a bit controversial, the caution I would inject, is having a well-defined semi-classical limit below the Planck scale. So if you're willing to accept that the pure Cardano state has such a limit, okay, then, but what do we mean by a well-defined semi-classical limit when you have matter fields? So you want something such that if you were to turn off gravity, the wave function of the universe would correspond to or what you would get in that limit. So if you think that's Minkowski spacetime, the usual quantum field theory, we could certainly construct generalized Cardano states that reduce to that limit below the Planck scale, that are fully consistent with all the dynamics of quantum gravity. And then conversely,
what's semi-classical about it? Psi is not quantized?
It is quantized, but...
So what does the word semi-classical mean?
Well, it means that there is a Hamilton-Jacobi functional, just like a Chern-Simons functional, of the gravitational and matter fields on the spatial hypersurface that you could define as a wave function that's analogous to Chern-Simons. And when you turn off the matter fields, the wave function would reduce to the pure Cardano state. When you turn off gravity, the wave function would reduce to whatever semi-classical limit you're trying to verify. So if you're looking at scattering experiments between electrons, whatever they are, we know what the boundary states, the boundary conditions look like for that. You basically input that into a machine, and it cranks out this state. And so it leads us to the principle of the semi-classical quantum correspondence. And that says that in order to obtain a finite state meeting those criteria in quantum gravity, you have to consistently and exhaustively apply all of the commutation relations defined in theory. So you think about the usual commutation relations in field theory between amongst fields. Okay, so at space-like separation, they commute. With their conjugate momenta, their non-trivial commutation relations. So those are some that are pretty familiar, but now if you have gravity and matter fields, now you have cross-commutation relations between gravitational variables and matter variables. Now, it may seem on first sight that those cross-commutation relations should be trivial, okay? And certainly at the level of the commutation relations, they seem trivial. But in terms of their implementation on the wave function. Due to the form of the wave function on a spatial hypersurface, they have non-trivial physical content. So you actually have to make use of that physical content, literally all the commutations exhaustively, in order to produce a state. So that's my interpretation of quantizing relativity consistently with the axioms of field theories is using the commutation relations. There may be some additional requirements, but those are the minimum kind of criteria that that have to be enforced by this interpretation. And there are some papers that introduce the ideas. So the general procedure. So what I'm talking about in this lecture is I'm talking about generalizations of the pure Kodama state. So the one that we introduced at the beginning. But that's not the only state that you could apply that to. There is actually a two-parameter family of states that are like the Kodama state. They have the same properties, but they're labeled by two arbitrary functions, two arbitrary constants per point. So that's two arbitrary functions. So you could build a Hilbert space on those wave functions. So I've selected one of those wave functions that corresponds to the pure Kodama state. And I'm going to generalize it by coupling it to matter fields. So the general procedure is, it was discovered by Ted Jacobson, Capovilla, and Dell that if you make a certain substitution, so what I have here is at the classical level, on the left-hand side, there's a densitized triad. And what I've essentially done is I've factored out the Ashtakar magnetic field. So what's left over is an SU2 cross SU2 valued matrix. And I call that the CDJ matrix. So I named it after the authors. But I use a matrix in a different way than they use it. So that matrix, actually they use the inverse of the matrix. It's used as an auxiliary field to impose metricity on the theory. So if you're familiar with spin foams, the simplicity constraint that says essentially that the metric can be related to triads and two forms, the Lagrange multiplier would impose that. But the way that I apply it is I use that as a dynamical variable that gets quantized. So it has a conjugate momentum.
But for the time, can you move a bit up so that they can see? If you need a pointer.
Thanks. So think of this as being more of a change of variables than an ancess. And as long as the B field is non-degenerate, which is an assumption that I've analyzed in this talk, you can certainly do that transformation. And you can quantize that variable. We'll see that the condition of non-degeneracy has to do with the existence of matter fields in the theory. You need it to be non-degenerate for that to be the case. Now, if you were to take this ansatz and substitute it into the constraints, I'll show that in the board perhaps in a moment, you could solve the constraints, all of them at the classical level, whether you have pure gravity or you have matter fields as well. And essentially what you do is the constraints are written in terms of this quantity and that quantity and matter fields. But now you've rewritten the constraints as a condition on this matrix. And when you solve the constraints at the classical level, it tells you what the elements of the matrix are. So that's been done at the classical level by Tiemann. That's a paper there.
I'm not sure Thomas would claim, because what you're saying is that if you were able to do that, it means that you're essentially claiming that you're able to solve completely classical general relativity.
In the case when the
field is... That's the thing, that you're able to solve the constraint, the statement is that you're just giving the full solution.
But that's an answer.
Of GR. No, no, it's not an answer.
That's when it's non-degenerate.
When it's non-degenerate, it's fine.
Yeah. Yes, you can.
You know, even there.
You can do that, yes.
So, you know, I think you should. You're going to, this is part you're going to show on the blackboard?
Yes, I'm sure.
I don't want to keep seem like you might be on the ground. In the case of the pure sitter that you did before, where you have exact kodama,
yes,
the sigma is like E, and so the psi is E over B, and E over B is something simple in the.
For the pure kodama state, this matrix is
matrix of one.
The isotropic matrix, so it's delta AE.
That's the line down there.
Yeah.
Times so
the delta AE is the sitter part, and then the epsilon part is due to the sources.
Yes, and I'll explain that as well.
So here, I think maybe, yeah. I mean, Kapovira, sure. Jacobson, they wrote these things, they made the substitution, but then they stopped because the Gauss law becomes a complicated stuff. I don't think Thomas, I mean, if Thomas, you know, maybe you did this full solution, then you should claim what you meant. You know. Anybody that does that as a claim for
okay.
Instant fame, right?
Well, so let's see. Yeah.
I'll show you. So, I'll sketch out the solution. Maybe I'll do it here. So, okay, so I write out the constraints, right? So, we know what constraints look like for pure gravity. So, the diffeomorphism. So, I'm looking just at pure gravity. I could put matter if you want. But, look something like this, and so I've substituted that variable. So you see where this came from? It came from so you put in that variable. Now, due to the index structure, that tells you that this is antisymmetric in AE. So the anti-symmetric part of this matrix you can assume is zero, so it's symmetric. Now, next thing you do is you go to the Hamiltonian constraint. We'll get to the Gauss constraint in a minute. But the Hamiltonian constraint in those variables looks like this. So it starts out as so you make a substitution. And you transform this into form. So you get the determinant of the matrix. And then there's a term which I call the variance. I'll call it var sine. So what I mean by the variance is trace of psi squared minus trace of psi squared. So now what you do is, since you have a symmetric matrix, so you diagonalize it by an orthogonal transformation, a complex orthogonal transformation. So now you can write this constraint in terms of the eigenvalues. I'll just write it as O times some diagonal matrix. Lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, something like that. So we'll see how this comes into play in the Gauss constraint, but you can parameterize the matrix O as e to the theta dot t, where where these are your three complex angles, and you rotate the matrix into a given orientation. And this T are the generators in SF3. But when you put it in here, because of these are all the invariants of the matrix at the classical level, you essentially get lambda times the product of the eigenvalues, so lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3. And then here, this term here gives you 2, lambda 1, lambda 2, just lambda 2, lambda 3, just lambda 3, lambda 1. So you agree that you can solve for lambda 3 as a function of lambda 1 and lambda 2. So you have two arbitrary functions you could use for lambda 2. And that determines lambda 3.
That is, that line there is equal to 0.
Yes.
And therefore, you can drop the determinant of B because it's non-degenerate.
Yes.
Yes, OK. And then you have a cubic equation and three variables, basically.
Yes.
Good. OK, so you can solve the.
So you go to the Gauss constraint. I'll show you the constraints on the next slide, but essentially, the Gauss constraint is a differential equation in these variables. So if you take and then you plug in the intercepts. So show it explicitly. Rule. And then this term, because of the Bianchi identity, then you're left with this term. So right, this is so now you're taking the covariant derivative of this matrix. Now, you have to go into the tensor representation of the covariant derivative. And the way you can see that is, if that were the pure quadratic state, this would be delta AE. And essentially, you would have something similar to what you get in Minkowski space-time that the Minkowski metric is consistent or compatible with anti-symmetric connection. So you could write down the analogous connection for the matrix for the pure quadratic state. But for the generalized quadratic state, this would essentially look like something like, let me write this as all this d by d, t e, so that's d by d x I. And you'll have some term that looks like a times b with the right index structure. Something like this. Okay. So now, if you, what you have to do is you put in that form of the matrix. So this is, you take the O times the lambda matrix of eigenvalues, O inverse, O transpose. Then you bring these guys out. So it looks more like a big matrix O in a tensor representation acting on a vector. So you plug this in here. And you turn this into a differential equation for theta. Because you know these eigenvalues. So you're solving a set of three differential equations for theta and three unknowns. Now you might say, okay, well, the equation looks highly nonlinear, highly non-trivial to solve. But the way I solve it is, you could write this as something along those lines if you combine the representations. And then you expand it. So this becomes, and then there's a remainder. So these are terms of order theta squared. So what you do is you and I use this technique for many of the constraints, is you solve the linearized part first. So the linearized part would look like a differential set of three linear first order differential equations on theta in three unknowns. So let's say you have d theta. It will equal, and it will equal some inhomogeneous term that depends on these lambdas. So call this, I'm going to call it g of, well, let me use a different thing. Call it a lambda plus a remainder. That's a order of theta squared. So the way I solve it is I solve this part first. So you generate an infinite series. So you start with theta 0 is the inverse of this. So it's call this theta sub e, the zeroth order term, is the inverse of this operator acting on that. Okay. So it's invertible if you supply the boundary conditions. And you have your first iteration. Now you take this, and you plug it in here. So now you have, call it the zero error term, think of it that way. So it would equal theta sub zero. And now it's a function of lambda, which you've input, because you have a freedom to choose two of those eigenvalues. So you build a series. So now you go to theta 1. Basically, what you do is this. You build a series for theta n up here. So theta sub n plus 1 equals the inverse of what I call a lambda. That's the remainder evaluated at the previous.
Are you assuming that the lambdas, these eigenvalues, are constant throughout the space?
No, they're only constant at each spatial point. So what that means is you can choose them arbitrarily. You can choose at each point in space. You can choose a value for each of those lambdas.
Okay. So doing the Gauss constraint and solving the Gauss constraint, you're not supposed to put the constant.
No.
So the claim is that a solution of the initial value equations, the Einstein equations, is given by two free functions, which are lambda 1 and lambda 2. Lambda 3 is solved as a nonlinear function of lambda 1 and lambda 2, but with no derivatives, so point by point. And then you solve one differential equation to find the three thetas as a function of derivatives of lambda 1 and lambda 2 that you develop in a power series expansion.
Exactly.
And the claim is that this is the solution of the initial value problem.
This is the general solution of general.
So then you take a theta.
This is not the solution.
Is it limit?
No. So
it's a classic. Yeah. Solving the constraints classically is not the same as solving.
Okay.
We'll get into the quantum solution.
Yeah.
But the solution, right? So once you choose those functions, so you determine the angles of rotation for that matrix. Now you're right to have your solution. And this is a function of your lambda 1 and lambda 2.
For any, for that is,
yeah, yeah,
the solution is any A, any connection, is given by any connection, and lambda 1 and lambda 2, okay, then you get the psi, which is only which involves the A because it's the covariant derivative, and then sigma is a function of A in lambda 1 and lambda 2. Right, so I think I agree with Laurent. Either there's a mistake somewhere, or this is fantastic.
Oh, this is the major result of GR in the past 10 years. So I mean, these are more than just a few minutes. Yeah. And there's two options there, right?
Don't you raise the board.
I give you some notes. So maybe we need to look more.
We can go into more detail.
That detail, but you need first to realize, that you cannot make such statement. Right? It's a very important statement. Just
yes, I realize it.
Good.
But I haven't talked to very many people, so it seemed normal.
You mean to be able to solve GR? Where the initial value point of GR.
Well, okay, so you have like more or less 15 minutes to go, so maybe you want to go
ahead. So what do you do?
Anyway, keep.
Yeah.
So what do you,
I don't think it's impossible. I mean,
so what do you do is now you're trying to incorporate matter fields. So what you do is you expand the CDJ matrix essentially in fluctuations about the isotropic matrix. Now you could put in, that could be lambda AE, which depends on lambda 1 and lambda 2. So you have a two functional family of solutions you could put there. But we're just looking at the pure lambda state in this talk. Now, I mentioned that the original authors used that matrix as a Lagrange multiplier, but now it's a full dynamical variable. So we're going to plug that into the constraints. So those are the constraints written in the language of that matrix. The first two, diffeomorphism and Gauss kinematic constraints, those ones are familiar probably, but this third constraint is called the mixed partials condition. So it has to do with what I mentioned earlier about using all the commutation relations of the theory. So if you take the commutation between the conjugate momenta for the gravitational variables and the matter variables, okay, that should give you zero because they're independent dynamical variables. Now, you can turn that into a condition on that matrix by looking at the integrated form of that constraint. So this is a functional integral in the functional space of fields. And notice that there's a term on the right-hand side. That's a constant of functional integration because I'm integrating in connection superspace. So the most general constant that one can have is an arbitrary function of the matter fields in the theory. So this F is actually our link. That's our link to the physics below the Planck scale. Because what you do is that corresponds to the semi-classical, well, it basically corresponds to the eigenvalue of the momentum operator on the wave function that corresponds to matter fields on Minkowski spacetime. And then you read it off. So you could choose that function arbitrarily. It's an arbitrary function. But since I want to make the link to sub-Planckian physics, I choose that to reproduce the wave function of the universe when there is no gravity. See how that works. Now we get to the Hamiltonian constraint, and see, the thing about the kinematic constraints is, as they're linear in momenta, you could say that the quantum version of the constraint and the classical version have the same form. So in other words, you don't get any new information from the quantum constraints that you didn't already have in the classical constraints. That's because they're linear in momenta. Now, the Hamiltonian constraint, it's cubic in momenta, so you have three functional derivatives here and two there. Okay, so we'll talk about how we deal with that. But one dilemma is you could think that if you can't satisfy the constraints of the quantum level, then you've broken the semi-classical quantum correspondence because you've gone to a non-linear constraint. And you could also think that you've violated the constraints of relativity at the quantum level, so that wouldn't be a proper quantization. Now let's have a look how we deal with those functional derivatives. So you might be wondering that, so you have multiple functional derivatives in the Wheeler and DeWitt equation, so it's not well defined. So what you do is the following, is you quantize the CDJ ansatz I listed before. So that okay. So left-hand side is a momentum, so this is linear in momentum. And the right-hand side is entirely in terms of configuration variables. There are no momentum. And in the process of solving the constraints, even at the classical level, that matrix would acquire functional dependence on the configuration variables. So quantize. So we take our wave function. So if you take, so this is a functional derivative. So this is our generalized command state. So this equals.
I know it's coming. Go, keep going.
This equals psi AE, which is a local function of the fields. A of x, psi of x, BIE. So what have I done? Okay, set the semi-classical quantum correspondence. It's linear in momenta, so the classical and the quantum version of the constraints are the same. There's no difference between them. So what I've done is I've just written that out. Okay, so now we're going to evaluate the functional derivatives. So perhaps a simpler example.
Okay, just stop here. So forget matter field and let this go.
Yeah, back. Forget matter field.
Okay. Psi knows about the theta, the EDI theta, the two free functions lambda, the A. So now I'm at some point in the
not
space,
yet.
In the space of A's. Oh, so you don't use the classical solution there?
Not yet. What you do is you first expand it. Then you expand because you're trying to solve for the epsilon AEs. So you first expand this in its generality by taking functional derivatives.
But why is psi a local function? I mean, from at least maybe I'm totally confused, but in your solution procedure, I would think you would get non-local function.
Well, what I mean is this. So if you look at a spatial hypersurface, sometime t, wave function is e to the integral e cubed x of some function, call it c of s, c of the fields. So that's the most general wave function you take. It has support in free space. So for example, for the loop states, you can choose this function such that the wave function has support on a loop by using delta functions. So when you take the functional derivative, and you get some numerical coefficient as a result of integrating the delta functions. And so that's a local function of the fields. So it's a function at the point x of the fields. So that's the most general wave function we selected.
You limit attention to such wave.
Yes, well, there's no loss of generality by choosing this wave function. All I've said is it's e to the I. So it looks like this I could be the Hamilton-Jacobi functional, or it could look like a Lagrangian on in three space. And but we've just taken a form of the wave functional, and we bring down functional derivatives of this term. But the first functional derivative gives you a finite function of the fields at the same point.
What if C is local fields? And you're assuming that.
It's an ansatz, I would say. It's an assumption about the property of the C.
I don't think there's an assumption here because this could be anything. Let's call it I. So you have, I guess in the sense that, I mean, I've assumed it's an integral over free space. So, for example, the term Simons functional is an integral over free space.
I would certainly be the case there, but
I don't see any reason why a wave function has to be an integral, exponential of the integral of some local Lagrangian like.
Well, I'm looking for wave functionals that have that reduced Chern Simons when I turn off matter.
I mean, it's certainly interesting to investigate what you can do with such wave functions.
Yes, so I'm looking at those types of wave functions that they reduce the proper classical limit when I turn off matter or turn off gravity. So I think that's actually very general. I mean, that's more general than a Wilson line.
Well, no, if you take the Frog Vacuum, for instance, the Frog Vacuum exponential of phi of x, phi of y, with a propagator in between, which is a kernel of gx, y.
Sure, you could have that.
If you take a local derivative, you could try to expand. If there's a mass, you can then expand that. And then this is generally. It's like a quantum effective action. It's generally a humongously.
Yeah, so it's all contained in this term. So whatever dependence is contained in that term, the constraints will tell us.
So will we now restrict attention to C's, which are local functions of the fields, or not?
So this C, so let's say you look at a particular point in space. So this is a differential function. Of the field at some point. But now you're doing it over all points. So you could, if you imagine putting the points on a lattice, then you could take a product of exponentials over the entire lattice.
Well, it seems to me there are two different claims here, and there's a little bit of cross purpose law. So one is the claim that if you start with this form, okay, then you can find a generalization of the Kadami state where there's also matter degrees of field. Okay, and so let's separate that. That's a clean statement. There's a second issue, which is whether this is the most general form you could take, and let's postpone that to the discussion.
Okay.
And also, you have 5 minutes to
wrap
up. Okay, so I'll get down to, so you take the functional derivatives, and you get delta cubed of zero squared and delta cubed of zero terms. And I can explain later where those come, but you could try and regularize them. And you find out that the leading order term is that. And the only way you can get a result that's independent of the regularization prescription is if you choose those coefficients to be zero. For the pure Kadami state, they're certainly zero. For the generalized Kadami state, you set them equal to zero. And then you look at the condition.
You mean the Q0, the Q1, and Q2 are set equal to zero?
Yes.
Good. OK.
So that's how you solve the constraint identically. So here is a semi-classical term. I have a Klein-Gordon scalar field coupled to gravity. So there's a semi-classical term, Q1 equals zero. This partial derivative was originally a functional derivative. But now it's a partial derivative of a smooth function of the connection at a given point. And then this is the Q2 equals zero, and that looks like kind of a functional Laplacian operator. But now it's those are just ordinary partial derivatives. So now, and notice the equation is non-linear because it has, so there is a cosmological term. It's non-linear. It's cubic, semi-classical level. You have a quadratic term here. So it's basically a map from the space of these matrix elements, which you can reduce to three by solving the kinematic constraints, a map from those to three constraints, so you should have a solution. So what does the solution look like? So that's a general form of the equation. I've written it out, putting indices, and so for fields that, for matter fields that are most quadratic in momentum, you can write them in that form. So that's a cosmological term, in terms of fluctuations about the Kadami state. And then this structure here depends on the matter fields. And then this term here is the same for all models. That has to do with determinants. And then this term here is a propagator for a third quantized theory. So in other words, if you look at the previous slide, you look at the linear terms, and you interpret that as being a third quantized theory because you're already second quantizing. That's a propagator. So guess where it leads? So you got a solution?
I got confused here somewhere. The deviations were we're beyond the Sitter space, right? The Kodama statements are the Sitter space, which has already the cosmological term in.
Yes, and now we're looking at
the cosmological term back in the game. It wasn't taken care of already?
Well, it's there. When you do the expansion, so when you expand about the Kodama state, then, yes, you get these factors that multiply the coefficients. They come from the Kodama state.
So this is, in the present, you're getting some kind of back reaction with the cosmological term talking to the rest of the matter terms.
Exactly. But now we're going to solve it exactly to all orders.
In 1 minute.
There you go. Feynman diagrams. So it looks like spin networks, except they're third quantized spin networks. So those are Wilson lines, but they're in functional space, not in free space. And then here are the matter sources. And then those terms are the structures that appear for a given model. And so that's the CDJ matrix. And so here is a wave function. So essentially, the way it works is you determine this function by the limit below the Planck scale to correspond to Minkowski physics. You input that here into that series expansion, so you get an infinite series in powers of g lambda, and you get a wave function. And write it in a different form. So there is a matter contribution, and there is a gravitational contribution. You can imagine that first term is the Kodama state. Then you get all these terms. And they have physical interpretations. And now you can do what I did with the Kodama state before. You can try and look at different representations. So something that looks like something in free space, a free hypersurface. Four-dimensional space-time, it looks kind of like an instanton term. But now this depends on the matter fields through that expansion. Feynman diagram-like expansion. And there is a matter contribution. And so those are some of the areas. A lot of those areas are I've completed. But the Hilbert space structure, now you're looking at, if you look at a two-functional family of solutions labeled by lambda 1 and lambda 2, you can build a Hilbert space on that. And then if you notice that the wave function has a form of, if you take your auxiliary wave function as one of those lambda 1, lambda 2 functions, and you tensor it with the matter wave function below the Planck scale, now you act on that with an operator, and it generates this generalized Kodama state. So you start from a Hilbert space, and you generate the state. So do you get a Hilbert space in the end? That's what I'm currently working on and demonstrating. And the only thing that I'm having trouble with in terms of matter fields is Yang-Mills, because Yang-Mills is non-polynomial in the variables. So you have to use a bit more delicate of a procedure to put it into that form where you can do the expansion. So I'm working on that now as well. And ultimate goal is a standard model.
Very remarks, questions.
Okay. Yeah, in fact, there are two expansions, right, for the parameter. Like, the first one was the theta, and the last one was the Feynman diagram. And the first question is, so the theta came up when you wanted to solve the Gauss constraint. What you described there, is that a general procedure to really solve the Gauss constraint, or does it depend on how far you go with the theta? If the theta is...
Well, it turns out that
it
turns out that you don't really need the theta. What you do is, if you want to get an explicit solution to the constraint, you can. But when you're building the Kodama state, what you can do is you can rotate that matrix into a configuration where it's diagonal, and you don't have to worry about the Gauss constraint. But if you do want to worry about the Gauss constraint, to do it in other variables that aren't as nice. And yes, you build an infinite series. So if you imagine you want to look at solutions that are close to the pure Kodama state. The pure Kodama state is the the isotropic case.
Well, let's talk about GR. You're solving the constraints, right? We don't have to immediately think about the economic state. So,
okay.
So is that a general solution, or is it not?
Yes. So this theta, you can solve for theta in terms of those two functions. So you have two free functions. And those two free functions label the matrix, they label the state. And that's the gravitational aspect of it.
And that expansion was the one with G lambda, right?
Yeah.
And that depends on the size of G lambda for it to work, right?
Well, it depends on that. But G lambda is, I mean, very small, right? So that's what I meant before, is if it were small, right, then the expansion would be very good.
What is the initial data you need to solve that differential equation?
Yes. Okay. So it's a differential equation in three space for three angles.
Okay.
So you
need three angles at every point.
No. What you have to do is you pick a two-dimensional hypersurface, right, within the space of those angles, and then you specify, let's say, theta 1 and theta 2 on that surface, and then now you're integrating in the theta 3 direction. And that gives you theta 3 as a function of position. And you do the same thing for theta 2 and theta 3, and then for theta 3 and theta 1. So you're looking essentially at the boundaries of, think of it as being a cube. If you specify the angles on those boundaries, now you can determine them uniquely in the interior in accordance with the differential equation. So it's sort of like a Frobenius theorem for first order differential equations. But yes, you do put in boundary data to get a solution. So that's one thing you put in. Then the other thing, of course, are those functions, lambda 1 and lambda 2. You choose those.
So what, do you want to go ahead,
Michelle? Please
go ahead. Yeah. So the logic is something like this. Given we're on the space of E's and A's to start with, we're looking for the constrained surface. And so what you have is an initial value, is an algorithm to produce a solution. The algorithm is choose any A's on three manifold. We're just looking for initial data. Okay? And choose two functions, lambda 1, lambda 2. Solve for them. I'm just repeating myself from before, but I'll go further. Solve for lambda 3. Then you have everything but the Gauss constraint. And everything has been local, no derivatives. The Gauss constraint has one derivative, and you have then an iterative procedure to solve that differential equation with one derivative. By inverting the derivative operator, you get a...
Yeah, but it's easy to read. Okay, let's go in for good reason. I mean, because the question is, can you solve the question? If you could, then you find...
Right. So well, I'll get there. Okay. Let me get there. Okay. Given initial data for the thetas on a two surface, okay, you have a formal solution. This formal, we haven't yet discussed whether that power series converges.
Or that where the D's were defined, it seems to be defined.
Right. We're just collecting issues here. Yeah. But at a formal level where those questions are answered, you have a solution by a power series expansion to the constraints, to the classical constraints. Okay. Then you take that, you go back to the semi-class, you go back to, and you basically, given that, you have a procedure to construct a semi-classical wave function that is a wave function of the form of e to the I times the interval of something.
And also quantum.
Right, which satisfies the constraints, and which satisfies the constraints in a particular way, in which basically you collect coefficients of those powers of delta and require that they be zero.
Exactly.
Power in the multiplication of functional derivatives, there are some regularization issues, and you collect basically powers of delta of zero and you insist, so you say there's some detailed regularization which gives you functions times divergences, and you require that the coefficient of all the three divergences vanish.
In order that it's regularization independent.
Right. And Bryce DeWitt used to just say delta 0 is 0 and its powers are 0, but you're not doing that.
No.
Good.
No.
And okay, so that's the schema. And the important question is, how much do you know about the technical issues about converting the formal schema into explicit solutions? Both
so
and that's the two expansions that.
Yeah, so what you have to do is so for example for the propagators, you have to be able to invert the kinetic operators. So if you go to the previous slide, I'll show you the constraint. So if you look at this constraint, so this is at the level prior. I mean, it depends on how you solve them. You can solve them by the full-blown constraints. In other words, you write down the Hamiltonian constraints, you have your three conditions there, plus the six kinematic constraints, plus the mixed partials condition. So that's 9 plus n equations in 90% of nodes. So let's say you arrange that into a big 9% by 9% matrix. Now you've got to read out the propagator for the third quantized interpretation. So you look at the linear terms here, there's a linear term there. And I'm looking just at the Hamiltonian.
Can I interrupt a second? Supposing you were in a case where there were no matter fields, but you were expanding around not De Sitter, but the solutions you got from some non-trivial lambda 1 and lambda 2, there would be a similar form of this?
You don't need to do this then, because basically those functions, so this matrix lambda AE, you choose a matrix such that it doesn't have any functional dependence on the field. So those are two labels. When you take the multiple functional derivatives, you get the semi-classical term because you don't get any delta cubes of zeros by acting on these.
So do you have the form of the wave function in this case? That is, it's no longer either the transignment invariant, but it's
yes.
either the
it's
something
this.
Which differs from the transignment invariant by some of these.
It looks like this. So the integral of and you can just write it as lambda a function of x. So this is a function just of on the hypersurface. Xae. Now this xae, I'll have to explain. This comes from connection one forms. You might be familiar.
The lambda are just the size. So those are functions ultimately of a and lambda 1 and lambda 2.
Yes.
So
then they contain that matrix, the orthogonal matrix.
Right.
But
the axis.
But you could, as I said before, you could rotate the coordinate system such that these are just lambdas of a's. Then you absorb all that complicated dependence into here. And then this becomes x or y of a. But now it's a functional of the lambdas of x. So now you can quantize these variables instead of these variables.
And the y are explicit functions of the functionals of the a. And the thetas,
mm-hmm.
which are functionals of the lambdas again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and those are solutions of some other differential type.
Solutions of the Gauss.
Right, so I'm just looking for them just to tie the notation together. So what is y in terms of the solution of the Gauss?
Okay, so this lambda AE is, you can write it as O times the diagonal ones times O inverse times XAE.
Right, now I'm just looking for what the X's are.
Oh, these. Okay, sure. So those come from some variables that were invented by Chopin Su. So we looked at the connection one forms. So So these are defined as being delta XAE. So for example, for the churn Simonis, if you take the trace. So if you could invert this transformation, if you could integrate this, then you get a matrix of nine elements. That would be there, but it would be a functional of the connection in some way. But in mini superspace, for example, you could write this in terms of the determinant of A. But in the full theory, there are some additional terms that involve derivatives of the.
Right, so this is sort of integrating up from a point in the space of connections up a direction. This, the x is the result of integrating this differential equation where you follow the vector field on the configuration space given by the b's.
Yes.
Okay. So that is something one could imagine as well defined.
Yeah, so you just choose that as being a basic variable.
Okay, I got that. Okay.
I want to ask an innocent question. I studied some years ago the work of Li and Laurent, where in the gravity case, with a column of a function, with a semi-classical function, and without matter, and they studied the fluctuations, and there was a divergence. And even in the Gaussian approximation, one sign of the Gaussian was wrong and the other sign was right.
There was an instability.
There was instability.
In the linearized, let's be careful.
Right. I haven't asked my question.
Okay.
As you know what you did, and I think that I know what you did, I would have hoped that when you put matter, that you would be striving to stabilize that.
Well. First, I'm not so sure that that there's a divergence. I mean, if you do the full blown theory to all orders, so you're not looking just at a linearized approximation.
No, look, in the Gaussian, there was one sign of the Gaussian that was wrong, and one side of the exponential was wrong, and then there was the cubic. So there was lots of trouble.
Well, you just choose.
And you're not addressing that trouble.
You just choose a measure, right? So. If these are your basic variables, so what's your measure? Well, if you're a Euclidean signature, Lebesgue measure. So in other words, it's delta function normalizable.
No, I don't think
in Lorentz signature, you just choose. So looking at just a pure gap,
plus or minus I, and not a plus or minus.
And just say it's
real.
That.
Is that what you're saying, that you have to put in a plus or minus I and that the instability is fake?
It doesn't matter. As long as you choose a Gaussian in terms of the basic variables, and it doesn't matter how large this term gets.
I don't understand.
So it's kind of like coherent state or Barman representation for the oscillator.
The columnar thing was with an I, e to the if, right?
That's one version.
And you had a wave packet and so on. And you had to imagine the path, and then you study fluctuations about that path. And to our dismay, to their dismay, the Gaussian fluctuations diverged. One sign was right, the other sign was wrong.
In the Lorentzian
linearization. E to the IS plus fluctuations.
Okay. So,
I'm not done. So that already at the quadratic level it was sick. And then there was the trouble in addition to that, to stabilize it, and you had to work with the cubic.
Mm-hmm.
So, there was real trouble.
Yeah.
And there was real honest to God trouble. And one of the hopes, I imagine, would be if you threw matter in, that you could stabilize it.
Well, see, I'm not looking at the quadratic level.
I don't see that that's
really right. So I think the point is very well taken. Right. I think it's sufficient to say that
my point is well taken.
Your point is well taken. Yeah. I think all you need to say to this is that, I mean, either you know the answer or this is worthy of doing research. I mean, you have something which is a new starting point for several of these questions, and I don't think you have to have more answers right now.
I have answers to this question.
Okay, well then I shut up and let you discuss it.
Okay, yeah, so I think... Yeah, so before, okay, so is there any other quick remark or anything? Otherwise, you can continue to discuss with Ayo, but we should thank him again.